Thank you very much, Karen. Good morning. But it's true. We're very familiar with hearing that invoked as a defense when someone is accused of speaking Lashon Hara. So the first thing we hear is, but it's true. And our first response to that is, well, that doesn't make a difference. Because we learn in school, in our early years, that Lashon Hara, the prohibition of speaking negatively about others, applies, perhaps especially, when what's being said is true. So the fact that the content may indeed be true isn't really much of a defense. But then we realize that the person saying, but it's true, isn't just offering a defense, but they're asking a question. But if it's true, why should there be anything wrong with it? And that's one of the central questions I think we have when we consider this prohibition of Lashon Hara, which is so familiar to us. There's so much written about it in our literature. We hear about it so frequently. We hear it so frequently. And the fact that it should include not only slander, not only if you're making up bad things about somebody, okay, that we understand. That's something that everyone can appreciate is wrong. Civil law recognizes that as wrong. If somebody slanders you, you can sue them in court. If somebody writes false things about you, that's libel. You can sue them. So, okay, if you're going to say false things, I can understand why that's a crime. But to say something true about someone, that should be prohibited, that should be such a severe prohibition that the rabbinic literature is so filled with talking about, it's always been a very difficult idea to understand. And I'd like to spend a few minutes with you this morning trying to consider some possibilities of why that should be. Why should it be that the Torah should prohibit and the rabbinic literature should condemn in such strong language something which seems to be okay, seems to be reasonable? And I think, and we'll get to this in a little while, but I think there's a major clue that's found in this week's parsha. So it's a particularly appropriate week to talk about this. If we could study part of this week's parsha together a little bit, we'll get a sense, perhaps, somewhat of an insight, somewhat of a clue as to why it should be that even that which we perceive to be true is included in this very strong prohibition. So first, let's take a step back and consider a little bit of what has been written, of what we find in the Torah and the rabbinic literature about Lashon Hara. And we'll start with a more positive orientation. There is a Medrash, it's also found in a different version in the Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah. It's well known in the form that it's in the Medrash. We'll mention a harmonized form of the story here. There's a story that's told about a mysterious peddler. The Medrash talks about a rochel, which is an interesting choice of words because, as we'll discuss, that's the same word that's used in the Torah to talk about someone who peddles bad stories, who peddles Lashon Hara. But in this case, it's a good peddler. In this case, it's a good rochel. The Medrash tells about a peddler, about a rochel, who arrived in the town of Tzipori, and he made an announcement. He said, "Who is it who's looking for the secret to life? Mi ha'ish hechafetz chayim. Who is it who wants to live a long life? Who wants to see long days? Who is it who wants to know the secret?" So immediately a crowd gathers around him. We all want to know. Everyone wants to know. What does he have? And he reaches into his bag, and what he pulls out is not a potion, but a parchment. It's a book of Tehillim. And he reads from the book of Tehillim, Mi ha'isha chafetz chayim, ohev yamim l'roz tov. Who is it who wants to live a long life? Nitzor l'sholcha meira, usfasecha midaber mirma. He should guard his tongue. He should be careful not to speak guile, not to speak badly about others. That's the secret. And you don't find that the people who gathered around him, that they're disappointed. They don't feel like they were tricked. Quite the opposite. They're very impressed. That really seems like that's quite an idea. And one of them who was gathered there was a big Torah scholar, Rav Yanai. And Rav Yanai said, "All my life I studied this and I didn't fully appreciate what it was saying. And now I realize what it means, and I realize also that here you're quoting from the book of Tehillim, written by David HaMelech, and his son Shlomo HaMelech said the same thing. When he said, Shomer Piv Ulishono, Shomer Mitzoros Nafsho. That one who is careful to guard his mouth and his tongue will save himself from all kinds of problems. So it's a nice medrash, a little bit difficult to understand what the big chiddush is, what the big new idea was that this peddler was able to teach even Rav Yanai. And there's been a lot of discussion as to what exactly its message is. And especially the fact that it's phrased in the positive, that it's not just telling you it's terrible to speak badly, but that avoiding speaking this way is the secret to life, apparently life in this world and life in the next world, and not only length of life, but quality of life, to having a meaningful existence, understanding what exactly is at the foundation of this issue, that's all a part of it. That seems to be the message of this peddler. It's a fascinating medrash which we have to try to understand in a little more detail. And of course, this task was taken up both in its name and its content in the past 200 years. My most notably, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, who authored the Sefer Chafetz Chaim, taking the name from the same pasuk, recognizing that not only is this an area of Jewish law that needs to be taught and that needs to be strengthened, but that there is a mission, that there is a positive approach one can take, that this is the source of enhancing one's life here and in the next world, and that this is something that has to be actively brought to the whole world. So the Chafetz Chaim took that mission up, wrote his now classic work, and over these past 150 years or so, this concept has gotten much more attention than it had in the previous centuries. So to try to understand a little bit of this attention and a little bit of this focus in the rabbinic literature, and there is quite a lot that is said, it's really a little bit staggering just to consider how many positive and negative statements we find in the Torah and in the later rabbinic literature about Lashon Hara. So first let's try to build a little bit of a foundation and talk about the Torah itself. So where do we find in the Torah the prohibition of Lashon Hara? How do we know from the Chumash that we're not supposed to speak negatively about others? So the truth is, there are a few candidates. There are a few different psukim in the Torah that exist to convey this message. Just to mention first, the most well known is the one that is found in Sefer Vayikra, in Parshas Kedoshim, where the Torah tells us, Lo seilech rochil b'yamecha, that we should not go, we should not walk or travel as, there's that word again, as a peddler, as a talebearer. It's a little bit of a discussion how exactly to translate the words. It's an unusual choice of words, but it's clearly understood in the rabbinic literature that this is a reference to peddling stories, to taking ideas, that's how all the Rishonim explain, taking tales about other people, bringing them from one place and taking them to another place, peddling your wares when your wares are all gossip, are all negative tales about others. That's what the Torah is directing us here when it says, Lo seilech rochil b'yamecha. There are a few other candidates as well. The Talmud points us to a pasuk in Sefer Dvarim, in Parshas Ki Tzetze, where the Torah tells us, V'nishmartem mikol dovar ra, that we should protect ourselves, we should keep ourselves away from every bad thing. And there is a rabbinic tradition to interpret the word davar sometimes as dibur. We should protect ourselves from any bad speech. And if that's the interpretation, as the Talmud suggests, so this is the closest we find in the Torah to the phrase Lashon Hara. This phrase, Lashon Hara, the common term that we use, which is all over the Talmud and all over the later literature, and the Chumash itself, we don't find that exact phrasing, except in this sense, if we interpret Davaraz Diborah, that's closer to Lashon Hara, that's another suggestion the Talmud has as a possible source. Then there's another major source, which comes from this week's Parsha, so we'll hold off on that and come back to that in a few minutes to discuss just how this week's Parsha also is a major part of the prohibition that we're discussing. In addition, we know we have entire parshios in the Torah that seem to be devoted to this. We have the parsha of Tazria and Metzora. which talk at great length about a spiritual malady, which is called tzaraas. It was a physical malady caused by spiritual activity, as the Talmud tells us, and most commonly it's associated with speaking badly about others. But Medrash tells us that Metzorah, the second of those two parshios, the word Metzorah is a contraction of the words Motzi, Shein, Ra, that if somebody speaks badly about others, that will cause them to suffer from this affliction, from tzaraas. So if that's the case, so then we have a lot of space in the Torah, even more than we've seen so far, telling us about just how dangerous this is. And we know we also have a cautionary tale about one of the great heroic women of Jewish history, of Miriam, that Miriam spoke Lashon Hara about her brother Moshe, and Miriam is afflicted with tzaraas. And the Torah tells us later in Sefer Dvarim that we should remember what happened to Miriam. That we should be careful not to get into the same kind of trouble. We should make sure not to speak badly about others and not to fall into the same trap. So already we find many, many different statements within the Torah itself, many different psukim, many different narratives within the Torah, all emphasizing just how problematic this behavior is. And in the Talmud it goes much farther. We'd have to spend all day just listing the statements in the Talmud. Rav Chaim Pelagi counts up in one place 40 different places in the Talmud in which you find strong condemnations of Lashon Hara. It's an ideal that is conveyed very powerfully in the Chumash and in all of the later sources. Sorry, question? She's asking about Yosef. And the truth is, Yosef there's a lot to say about. Yosef, discussing Yosef, maybe we'd have to come back sometime to talk about Yosef, because there's a lot to look very carefully at the Yosef story. The Torah tells us on the surface that Yosef seemed to be engaged in Lashon Hara. The language of the Pasuk is, Ve'yavei Yosef esdi basam ra el avihem, that Yosef brought the bad reports of his brothers to their father. And it's a fascinating section, because first of all, there is a debate. There are those who assume that Yosef could not have been engaged in prohibited Lashon Hara. What was Yosef's last name? Hatzadik, right? So it's hard to believe that Yosef would engage in Lashon Hara in the prohibited sense. So there are many who assume that this is a model for when it's permitted, and that causes a large discussion as to what we can learn from this section. There's some fascinating writings about looking very carefully at the psukim about Yosef to find a lesson as to how we know what we can and what we can't say. While others, such as the Chafetz Chaim, for example, were not so sure that Yosef was justified, and there are suggestions in the rabbinic literature that some of Yosef's problems were connected to that. So it's a long topic. It really requires a whole session of itself. God willing, someday we'll come back and talk about Yosef, because there's a lot to try to understand from looking at that parsha. But clearly we find a lot of attention in the Torah to Lashon Hara as something that's damaging, as something that's prohibited. We find that through directives, through mitzvos, we find it through stories, we find it through repeated mitzvos, and we find it in great length in the rabbinic literature. And in terms of the specifics, so the Rambam, I believe I put the Rambam in the sources, so the Rambam is one of many who set down some of the principles of Lashon Hara. So in his Mishnah Torah, in the seventh parak of Hilchos Deis, so the Rambam lays out four categories of Lashon Hara, four different ways to look at somebody who's engaged in this kind of behavior. So the way he defines it, he writes that there is Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara, as he understands it, refers to somebody who is disparaging someone else, but they're doing so with facts, with things that are true. And that's the point that we started with. Even though what they're saying could be true, even though they'll respond, what do you want from me? But it's true. Nonetheless, that's still prohibited Lashon Hara. By contrast, if it was actually false, if it's what we call slander, so then the Rambam says that's something else, that's called Motzi Shemer. Then there is a third category called Rechilus. Rechilus is slightly different. Rechilus is not that you go up to someone and say something bad about someone else, but instead you go up to someone and tell them what other people said about them. You tell them bad things that were said about them. And what he seems to be suggesting here is that this isn't so much about disparaging people, that's about starting fights. That if you tell people, this guy said such and such about you, you'll get all riled up and you'll get angry at them. So that's a third category. And the fourth category, the Rambam really innovates, is called a Baal Lashon Hara. That's somebody who rises to a new level of commitment to this kind of activity. As he puts it, somebody who sits and establishes himself as a person who consistently engages in this kind of speech, that's a Baal Lashon Hara. So here the Rambam tells us that we have four different categories to work with when talking about prohibited speech. We should clarify for the record that it's not 100% clear that these categories are from the Talmud, or even from the Chumash. It's not clear that when the Talmud talks about this, that he uses those distinctions. And there are some who suggest, for example, the Sefer Sechemed writes that the Rambam really used these categories for his own purposes, but in the Gemara you don't necessarily find that these are always the definitions that we're working with. So, for example, in the Talmud it seems that Lashon Hara is more of an umbrella term, and that Lashon Hara includes statements that are true and statements that are false. It's not clear from the Talmud that this distinction that we use nowadays, that the Rambam used, and that the Chafetz Chaim later used as well, of Lashon Hara being true and Motzi Shemra being false, it's not 100% clear from the Talmud that that's the kind of distinction that you find. And there are those who seem to be working off different definitions. So, for example, Rabbeinu Yonah, another one of the great Rishonim who wrote at length about this area in his Shari Tshuva, so there are those who understand within Rabbeinu Yonah that he sees it as a matter of degree. That if you speak bad about someone in a contained fashion, in a localized fashion, so that's Lashon Hara. But if you do so to such a degree that their reputation changes, that now people think badly about them because you've been doing it so much, so then that becomes Motzi Shemra. It's a question of degree. Lashon Hara is more contained and Motzi Shemra takes it to the next level. Alternatively, there were those, even recently, who had different categories. For example, there was a great Talmud Chacham who died in the Holocaust, who's known as the Kajagla Varav. You can see his picture here in the YU library on 5A, because that floor was dedicated in memory of him. So he writes, bringing other proofs, that he thinks that Lashon Hara refers both to things that are true and things that are false. They're both included in the prohibition of Lashon Hara, assuming that it's something that's not of consequence. If it's something that's of serious consequence, if it's an actual transgression of serious consequence, so then it's prohibited only if it's false. And he calls all of that Lashon Hara. So we find different categorizations. It's not so clear that these categories are also in the Talmud. Rechilus, for example, also, we find, especially because that's the language of the Pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, we find Rechilus used also as an umbrella term. This distinction with Lashon Hara being reporting something negative and Rechilus being telling people what was said about them, that also, it's not clear it comes from the Talmud. Perhaps the closest hint to that is there is a statement in the Talmud. The yeshiva right now is learning Sanhedrin. We talk all about the Batei Din and the like, which is one of the major themes of this week's Parsha as well. So the Talmud says that if you have a panel of three judges on a Beis Din, and one party loses in front of Beis Din, Reuven and Shimon come in front of Beis Din, and Reuven wins and Shimon loses. So the Talmud says that one of the judges, let's say it was a 2-1 vote, so that one judge shouldn't come to Shimon who lost and said, "You should just know I voted for you. It was the other two who voted against you." And the Talmud says, if you do that, you're in violation of Lo Seilech Rachel B'Amecha. That's the kind of revealing secrets that's not appropriate, that's covered by this prohibition of Lo Seilech Rachel B'Amecha. So if we focus on that example, so perhaps that's what the Rambam is getting at, that you're reporting what happened to other people's discussions, other people's conversations, in a way that's likely to get this individual angry at those people who were speaking. So maybe that's where he gets it from, that's how we understand Rechilus. But in any event, these categories are not explicitly defined this way in the Talmud, but it's the way we talk nowadays ever since the Rambam and the Chafetz Chaim. Seems to be an efficient way to distinguish between different components, and that's essentially how we use the definitions nowadays. Hi. So we'll get to that, and that's one of the major themes that's in this week's Parsha. Of course, there's much more to talk about as well. You could talk Lashon Hara forever. There's a lot of Lashon Hara to say, so we'll have to invite me back to get into more detail, but I certainly want to get that a little bit today, especially because, as we'll see, that's the theme which is most clearly addressed in this week's Parsha, which is going to be a big focus that we'll try to look at in a few minutes. Okay. Hi. No, we didn't get to that. That's also a big topic. So we'll have to, she asked, I should say the question was about listening, and your question is about newspapers. So listening, God willing, we'll get to a little bit, even though there's a lot more to say about it. So we'll have to come back. So Karen will have to take notes. We'll have to come back to talk about that. So far, we have to come back to talk about Yosef. We have to come back to talk more about listening, and we have to come back to talk more about newspapers. But Karen mentioned if you want to get a hold of the book afterwards, you'll find a lot of that discussed there as well, if you want. But in any event, so it's helpful perhaps to get a little bit of a perspective on the damage that we're talking about by using a phrase that appears in the Gemara in Maseches Erchin. In the Talmud, you don't have a whole tractate, you don't have a whole Masechta that's devoted to the laws of Lashon Hara. You have a few sections here and there. The largest concentration in the Talmud Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, is in Maseches Erchin. I think most of that is related in the sources. So in the source packet, you'll see a Gemara Maseches Erchin, where, among other statements, the Gemara says that Lashon Hara is called Tlisoi. It's called, that's Aramaic for three. It's the three-part transgression, because, says the Talmud, Lashon Hara is so damaging that it's Horeget Shlosha. It kills three. Now, what does that mean? Who are the three who are killed? So the three who are killed are the subject, the speaker, and the mekabel, the listener, the recipient. So that's a fascinating statement, and the Rishonim have interesting interpretations of what it means, but we're going to use it as a tool to consider the different ways in which Lashon Hara inflicts damage. So the first, that it damages the subject, that's probably the most obvious. So we understand that clearly a victim of Lashon Hara is the person you're speaking about, the subject. And that damage happens in a few ways. So clearly their reputation will be affected by what's being said. And that itself is considered to be significant. Reputation, as we know, is something that has value in and of itself. That's true both in halacha and in secular law. That reputation is recognized as an asset. It's something that someone earns through their life work, through their sweat equity. They earn their reputation, it has inherent value, and somebody who damages it is doing actual harm, is actually taking away from that reputation, and that itself is a damage that's significant. Now you might say, well, okay, but perhaps that's appropriate. A reputation, if it's going to be meaningful, so it has to be subject to such variation. It has to be that a reputation can't be guaranteed no matter what the person does. It makes sense that if a person is doing something irreputable, so then they should be subject to a loss of reputation. Why should the halacha protect them against their reputation changing if indeed they're behaving in such a way that causes people to talk about them? So that's a fair question. It's part of the question we started with, aye, but it's true. So why should it be a problem? So we'll try to address that in the next few minutes. And together with the damage to reputation, so there is all kinds of other damages that can emanate from that, that one who is spoken badly about can lose a job, can lose a shidduch, can lose friends, can lose opportunities, all kinds of other harm can emanate from being spoken badly about, and clearly that's also the way in which the subject suffers. Now again, you might say some of these might be deserved, maybe that's appropriate, maybe that has to happen. So again, that's something, God willing, we'll come back to in a few minutes. So to say that the subject is hurt, is one of the three victims of Lashon Hara, that's the one we probably understand most clearly. The idea that it also hurts the speaker is a little bit less intuitive, but that we probably also could figure out if we think about it, that the person who is indulging in such speech is really lowering themselves, is taking themselves to a bad place, is engaging in a certain kind of degradation of the soul that has a cumulative effect. Many point out that Unklus in Parshas Bereishis, when talking about the spirit of humanity, uses the phrase ruach memalala, that a person is defined by the ability to speak. We find in all of the philosophical sources that the power of speech is one of the core defining elements of who a person is, and to degrade that power, to use it for less than savory purposes, has a tremendous effect. And we find, in fact, that some of the halachic analysis, when they try to understand what is it that's so terrible about Lashon Hara, so they point to two different components. On the one hand, the fact that it inflicts harm on someone else, the damage to the subject we mentioned a minute ago, and also that it's a terrible character trait, that it's a midorah that has an effect on the soul. And that's something that we also have to pay attention to. It's fascinating that the Chafetz Chaim in his Sefer, when he talks about the prohibitions of Lashon Hara, so he lists all the different places in the Torah that we find the condemnation of Lashon Hara. So he goes through some of what we've mentioned already, some of the different psukim which seem to address themselves to Lashon Hara, and he has many more. He has a very long list, and some of the things that he lists are a little bit debatable, a little bit arguable. You have to look to very specific circumstances. If you speak Lashon Hara about your parents, so it's a violation of Kibbud Av V'Aim. If you speak Lashon Hara in a shul, it's a violation of Es Mikdash Ha'Tiro. He goes on to list many different additional prohibitions, some of which are a little bit more arguable than others. One of what he lists there, you wouldn't expect to find that it's controversial, and it's surprisingly controversial. It's a little bit surprising that this was the topic of Machlokas. But the Chafetz Chaim writes that one of the prohibitions that is violated when one speaks Lashon Hara is Chil Hashem, is profaning the divine name. So surprisingly, the Chazon Ish took issue with this. The Chazon Ish argued it's not a Chil Hashem. What's the argument about? Why would you say it is a Chil Hashem or it's not a Chil Hashem? So it sounds like what the Chafetz Chaim was focusing on when he said that it's a Chil Hashem as opposed to other Averas. Why is it more of a Chil Hashem than any other Avera? So he writes, because Lashon Hara, there's no personal benefit. If I steal money from you, okay, so I'm getting something. If I eat non-kosher food, okay, so I'm enjoying the non-kosher food. But if I speak badly about someone, there's no personal hana, there's no benefit. It's only to indulge in the Avera. So he writes, that's a Chil Hashem. And the Chazon Ish disagreed. He said, there's no personal benefit, there's no enjoyment in speaking Lashon Hara. This is proof, he wrote, that the author, the Chafetz Chaim, never tasted the taste of Lashon Hara in his life. He must never have indulged. He doesn't know that people do enjoy it. People do enjoy speaking this way. It's interesting also, the Chafetz Chaim in the footnotes over there, there are a few other suggestions as to why it might be a unique Chil Hashem. He also notes that it's a Chil Hashem because it's the kind of Avera that, a little bit like the frogs in the Mitzrayim, that the more you hit them, the more they expand. So the Chafetz Chaim notes, like we started, but it's true, that if somebody speaks Lashon Hara and you try to object, you try to correct them, so the first response will always be to double down. The first response will be, oh, you think I shouldn't say what I'm saying? Let me tell you why I have to say what I'm saying. Let me tell you why it's so important. That person is so terrible, I should be saying more. So the usual reaction is to double down and to increase the Lashon Hara so it grows in a unique way. So he suggests also it's another reason why it's a Chil Hashem. In some of the later sources, they say the definition of the Chil Hashem is when people take something very serious, take a prohibition that's very grave, and they treat it casually, they treat it like it's nothing, that's a Chil Hashem. So if that's the definition, then you can see there's probably no better example than Lashon Hara, and that might be another reason to call it a Chil Hashem. But in any event, question about that? Right, that's a complicated scenario, because you're also bringing up the topic, which again, Karen will have to come back to talk about this, about when Lashon Hara is necessary to protect others. We call Toeles purposeful Lashon Hara, which also relates to the Yosef question. So we'll see how much we can touch upon that, but it opens up all kinds of other areas that also require a lot of attention. Again, we could speak Lashon Hara all day, so we'll see how much we can try to cover in the next few minutes, but you're bringing up a very important point. So this question of Chil Hashem, that Chafetz Chaim was asserting there isn't really any Hana, so we who are more mortal, so we know that there is motivation sometimes behind Lashon Hara that isn't simple nastiness, there's a little bit more to it as well. So one of the most common motivations that we can discern is what's known in the halachic literature as miskabed deklon chaveiro, that a person who wants to become honored, a person who wants to increase their own stature through knocking down others. That's one way which is very common for people to try to feel big, to try to feel important, is to make others low, to knock others down to the floor. So it's clear that this is one of the major motivations, I think, that we find in engaging in Lashon Hara. And if that's the case, it's ironic, because in addition to all the statements that we find in the Torah and in the rabbinic literature and the Talmud and the Midrashim, so one of the most often quoted ideas is actually not explicitly in the Midrashim or in the Talmud, but it's from a later source. It's from one of the Rishonim, Rabbeinu Bachya, in his Chovos HaLevavos. There is an idea which you may have heard, you may not have realized from the Chovos HaLevavos. Chovos HaLevavos describes a scenario where after 120 years, so a person goes to the Olam HaEmes, a person goes to collect their reward in the next world, and they go to check on their spiritual account, they plug in their PIN number, and they want to check where all their assets, their spiritual assets are holding, and they're shocked. They look up their account, they find that all the mitzvot that they did, they're not there. There's no record. And there are all kinds of sins that are attributed to them that they didn't commit. So they ask, what's going on? This doesn't reflect my life. I don't understand. What is this account supposed to mean? And the answer that they get is, oh, you see, what you did wrong is you spoke Lashon Hara about other people. Because if you speak Lashon Hara about other people, what happens is they get all of your mitzvos and you get all of their averos. It's a particularly bad deal. So this is good to avoid, because look what kind of effect it has on your spiritual bank account. That's a fascinating idea which was very widely discussed. And among those who discussed it was Rav Dessler in his Michtav Melio. And he notes there two explanations why he thinks this might be. Why is this an appropriate onesh, an appropriate consequence for somebody who's speaking badly about others? He says, first of all, the damage that you do, your ability to hurt someone else by speaking about them, correlates to your personal stature. If nobody gives you too much importance, so they're not going to listen to what you say about other people. But if you're a distinguished person with a lot of accomplishments, so then you're going to do a lot of damage when you speak badly about someone. So in order to mitigate that damage, the consequence is your stature goes down, so you can no longer inflict so much damage on other people. That's one suggestion he has. But the other suggestion he has is that since the motive behind Lashon Hara so often is miskabed deklon chaveiro, you're trying to become important at their expense, you're trying to lift yourself up by knocking them down, so it's an appropriate consequence that the opposite happens. So you end up lowering yourself and pushing them up by talking badly about them, the exact opposite of what you hope to accomplish. And in addition, so the speaker, of course, like we mentioned before, is hurting themselves simply by strengthening the sense of negativity, by engaging in negative speech, by emboldening a sense of cynicism, by making this attitude the core of how they see the world. So that's another way in which the speaker hurts themselves, and this is something that the Rambam talks about in the Laws of Tzaraas, in Hilchos Tumas Tzaraas, at the end of that section. The Rambam says somebody who engages in negative speech, who strengthens that part of the personality, it's just going to go on and on that way, and they're going to speak badly about their friends, and then they'll speak badly about their rabbinic leadership, and then they'll speak badly about God Himself, and it's a train you can't get off so easily, so there is a lot of damage that happens not only to the subject, but to the speaker also. The speaker is also hurting themselves by engaging in this kind of speech. So we see so far two out of the three categories. The person who's being spoken about, the subject, they're one of the victims, and the speaker is also a victim. The speaker is also hurting himself by engaging in this kind of conversation. But the third category, and that's what we'll focus on for the next few minutes from our parsha, the third category is, as you asked, hamakablo, the recipient, the listener. And that's a very striking idea, that somehow the listener is suffering because of what's being said. Somehow the listener is being hurt. And this is a fascinating area to explore, and we'll try to give it as much attention as we can in the next few minutes, because that's the idea that really derives from this week's parsha, because the Talmud in Maseches Pesachim tells us that the source for the prohibition of receiving Lashon Hara can be found in Parshas Mishpatim, in the Parsha that we'll read this week. And there's a lot to notice about that. There's a lot that's really interesting about that. Because first of all, I could accept that there's some problem with listening, with receiving Lashon Hara. Listening may or may not be the right word, because that might not be the whole picture, but we'll say accepting, receiving Lashon Hara. So I could understand that that's a problem, because clearly that's what encourages the speech, and the speaker is not going to keep talking if nobody's there to receive. If there's no audience, he's not going to keep going. So I could hear that the listener is somewhat of an accessory, is somewhat of a partner in crime. On a secondary level, the speaker is the one who's really doing something wrong, but the listener is a necessary part of the puzzle, so we could understand why the recipient would also be a problem. But if that's the case, we wouldn't need a special source. We could be satisfied with what we already have. We know Lashon Hara is a problem, and therefore listening to it is also a problem. Why do we need a special source telling us that there's a problem to listen? As if it's a separate idea. As if it's an independent prohibition. That itself is very interesting. And what's even more interesting is there's a suggestion in the Talmud that this pasuk, which we'll mention in a moment, may actually be the core source. In which case, it flips things around. It's not that the speaker is the real criminal here and the listener is an accessory. But maybe it's the other way around, that the real Avera is in the receipt of Lashon Hara, is the one who is accepting it. And the speaker is the enabler. The speaker is giving the listener what to listen to. Which is a fascinating thought as well. And all of that is itself a question, but there's even more to ask when we look at the pasuk itself. So there is a pasuk that we'll read this Shabbos, where the Torah tells us, Lo sisa shema shav. And that's a little bit difficult to translate. We'll take a stab at it. But this pasuk, the Talmud says, is the source for the prohibition of receiving Lashon Hara, and might also be the source for the prohibition of speaking Lashon Hara. So what do the words mean? Lo sisa shema shav. It's a little bit difficult to translate. Sisa means to lift up. Linsos, to pick up. To lases, to carry, to perhaps give importance to give stature to. So the Torah is saying, lo siso, you shouldn't uphold, you shouldn't bear, you shouldn't hold on to. That's the first part of the pasuk. What is it that you shouldn't bear, you shouldn't hold on to? A shema, a report. Shouldn't hold on to a report. That is shav. So what does shav mean? So shav in other contexts in halacha means useless. Means unnecessary. So if that's the definition, it works very well. That the Torah is saying, Lo sisa shema shav, don't accept a report that's unnecessary. In other words, if somebody is giving you gossip, if somebody is telling you something that's not necessary for protection, it's not important, it's not significant, it's simple gossip, so then you shouldn't get involved, you shouldn't accept it, you shouldn't give it importance, you shouldn't lift it up, you shouldn't hold on to it, however you want to translate that word, lo sisa. That's what the message of the Torah is. So to translate it as useless would work well and would fit with other contexts. So for example, we have a prohibition in the Torah of shvuas shav and shvuas sheker. Shvua is an oath. If you take an oath, so there are different ways in which you could inappropriately take an oath. If you take an oath that the sky is green, so then that's a shvuas sheker. That's a false oath. If you take an oath that the sky is blue, so that's a shvuas shav. Because who needs you to take an oath the sky is blue? Everyone can look outside and see the sky is blue. I don't need to take a shvuah to tell people that the sky is blue. So that's an example of a shvuas shav. That's an unnecessary type of shvuah. So if that's how we translate shav, it works well. But what's interesting is if you look in some of the most important commentaries on Chumash, notably Rashi and Unkelus, so you see that they translate the phrase lo sisa shema shav to mean you shouldn't accept a report that is false. And that's a little challenging. Because if the Talmud tells us that this is the source for a prohibition to accept Lashon Hara, and we have defined Lashon Hara as at least including negative reports that are true, so why would this pasuk say don't accept a false report? Shouldn't it mean don't accept any negative report if it's not important, if it's not necessary for protection? So again, translating shav as useless would have been a good translation. But translating it like Rashi and Unkelus do as sheker, that makes it a little bit harder to understand, but at the same time, perhaps it's a clue. And perhaps all of this is a clue. Perhaps the idea that there's so much of a focus on the recipient, and the fact that this word sheker is invoked, and that this might be the key source, maybe all of that's a clue. And it's also noteworthy that the Rambam, when the Rambam quotes this Gemara, that the recipient is one of the victims, so the Rambam adds a little bit to the language. The Rambam says, "Hamikablo," and the recipient, "Yosur min ha'omro." The Mikablo, the recipient, is even worse than the speaker. So what does any of this mean? How do we understand any of that? So what this seems to indicate to us is that perhaps, yes, when we're dealing with Lashon Hara, so the speaker believes they're saying something true. They might think that they're saying something factual and accurate. But somewhere in between the speaker saying the words and the listener receiving them, the message comes out that's not true. Something that's false is being conveyed somehow by the time this conversation is finished. And that even if it's the case that the speaker thinks what they're saying is absolutely correct, somewhere along the line, it becomes false. It becomes sheker. And considering how that happens is a fascinating exercise, and it's something which we have a little bit more insight into thanks to some of what's been written in the psychological literature about how we're deceived sometimes by ourselves. How we think that we're saying things that are true, we think that we know what's true and what isn't true, and very often that's not the case. So, just to mention, for examples, some ways in which we think we're telling the truth, and we may not actually be telling the truth, and this is something that in the book we go into in some length. So, first of all, there is the fact that what we're saying might simply not be the whole story. It might not be a full picture. So maybe I'm saying a fact, but the picture that's being painted is a false picture. So yes, I didn't say anything not true. I only said factual things. But the listener, the report the listener is getting is a shema shav, is a false report. That's certainly possible. In addition, there is subjectivity. That it could simply be that I'm saying something that I believe to be true, but it doesn't necessarily correlate to actual reality in an objective sense. So just because I'm not making things up out of thin air, I'm not fabricating things, not what we call slander, but still the impact that I'm creating through my speech can again be one that is false. Another reason that might be the case is because memory is far more fallible than we'd like to acknowledge. We all think that we remember things very well, that we have a perfect recall of what happened, and very often we find sometimes to our horror that that's not really the case. And there are actually horrifying stories that you can read about eyewitness testimony, about terrible things that have happened in a courtroom setting where people have said what they believe to be the truth, and they've given testimony that they believe with absolute conviction to be completely true, and it turns out that it's not accurate. It turns out that the memory has eroded, that it's not actually as accurate as they believe it to be. And one researcher by the name of Ulrich Neisser did a study where he proved that even what's known as flashbulb memories are often not as accurate as people think they are. Flashbulb memories is a phrase that's used that when something terrible, chas v'shalom, happened, some major tragedy, some major piece of news. We just had the 30th anniversary of the Challenger disaster, which was, I think, actually used in this study. It was one of the examples. People hear something tragic and they always say, I remember where I was when I heard this, I remember exactly who I was talking to and what was going on. So I think it was actually that case that he did the study on, and he noted that a lot of people thought they remembered exactly where they were and who they were talking to, and they find out later that it's not true. That even in those cases where they think, this I will never forget, I have a perfect picture in my mind of how it happened, turns out not to be the case. Turns out to be a much weaker memory than they think. There is a researcher at Harvard who wrote a book called The Seven Sins of Memory. The researcher's name is Daniel Schachter. So that book is also very scary, because one of the things he discusses there is that it's not simply that we forget things in our memory, but there's also what's known as the misinformation effect. That not only do things disappear, but new things get added. And we think that that's true, that new ideas can come and replace our memory, and we could believe in things that never happened, not just forget things that actually did happen. And it's quite striking to read about how this happens. In his book, The Seven Sins of Memory, so he talks about seven different ways in which our memories are fallible, and among the sins that he lists there, so some of them are sins of omission, our memories leave things out, and some of them are sins of commission, that our memories make up new things, and we could be quite horrified to discover the extent to which that happens. So sometimes we simply don't remember accurately. We think things happened, and the truth is they didn't actually happen. We also have certain cognitive biases, and this is a major element, that the human mind has a tendency to believe things in a certain way, which also doesn't always contribute to 100% accuracy. So, for example, is what's known as a confidence bias. That people who speak with great confidence and they're absolutely 100% sure, so we tend to believe them. Even though studies will show that they are no more likely to be correct than people who don't speak like that. People who don't necessarily have that kind of confidence, but if you say, I'm 100% sure it's true, so then your listener will tend to believe you and take that to be the case, even though there is no real reason to take that as it is. In addition, the psychologists have also discussed at length a concept called the fundamental attribution error, which means that we tend to over-assess just how much a certain action reflects about a person, usually when it's somebody else. That if another person does something, that's indicative of who they are. They're always like this. That's their character. This defines them. Well, if I did the same thing, well, I was having a bad day, I was in a rush, this is not normally what I'm like, it was just a circumstantial event. So we tend to interpret actions that other people do as totally defining them. Well, when we do the same action, okay, for me it doesn't really mean so much, it's just the way things are. That's not necessarily so reflective of anything. There are many examples of that, but we're going to run out of time, so we'll just perhaps move on to a few others. So we also find what's known as the availability bias, that people have a tendency to think that the information that they have access to is the most relevant information. And information that they don't know about, they don't know that they're not necessarily factoring in. So to give an example, I encounter this all the time, because I teach young men, so I'm often asked about shiduchim. So very often when people ask about shiduchim, so they ask the people who are closest to the person they're asking about that they know. So for example, if I'm the only person somebody knows from YU and they're wondering about a guy from YU, so they'll ask me about this guy, even though I don't necessarily know this person. But I'm their only access to information, so therefore it must be that whatever information I would say is an accurate picture of the person. Very often that's not the case, but people don't always realize that the information that they have access to that's most available to them isn't necessarily going to be the most complete picture, and that's another example of a bias. It's another example of where people are sometimes led astray by their thought process. A very well-known bias is the confirmation bias. That people have a tendency to always give more weight to whatever information supports their initial instinct. In the first few seconds of interacting with somebody, so we form an opinion about that person, and then later on, whatever information comes, even if it's 50-50, so we tend to seize on the information that supports our initial analysis. And that also doesn't necessarily lead to an accurate picture. Sometimes we give people what's known as a halo effect, that if we know one good thing about them, so we tend to think that everything is good, which wouldn't be so terrible, except that there's also the inverse, what's known as the devil effect. If we know one bad thing about them, we tend to think that everything is bad. This is, again, a cognitive bias that we have that takes away from our really understanding what's going on with other people. And it's also part of a tendency that we have to try to avoid any ambiguity. We don't like to not be sure about something or about somebody. We'd rather have a clear opinion. So, if we're not really sure, but we feel we had an initial instinct, we'd rather seize upon anything which will push us in that direction and which will confirm that instinct that we have. And again, that's not necessarily accurate or fair, but that's the way we think. And we're also, of course, in an election season right now, so especially the way this election has been turning out so far, so we know we see what's called group polarization, that people who congregate with others of similar opinions tend to become entrenched in that opinion and tend to find they feel that opinion even more strongly than they did before. And again, that doesn't necessarily correlate to anything accurate. And there are many other biases we could talk about, but again, we're going to run out of time in a minute. But perhaps what's especially relevant is there's something that some researchers have called the bias bias, which means that we're not able to realize that we have a bias, that we feel that we're able to correct for all these tendencies. We don't even see that we have these inclinations in a certain direction, and therefore it's very hard for us to even realize that what we're thinking or what we're saying or what we're hearing may not actually convey the full picture. And therefore, it puts us in a very tricky position of having to be very careful. And all of this, as we see perhaps indicated in this week's parsha, is especially relevant when it comes to the listener. So we consider the Rambam statement, Hamakablo Yoser Min HaOmro, that the listener somehow is in bigger trouble, is damaged even more than the speaker. So perhaps that reflects another idea that some researchers have noted. There's a researcher named Baron who documented what he called the teller-listener effect, in which he showed that to whatever extent people don't really have the full story when they're speaking, people aren't necessarily completely accurate when they talk, to whatever extent that's true, the listener is getting an even worse picture. The listener is getting even less of the full story, is understanding even less about what they need to know. And that, if we think about it, we see how that plays out in our own experience. So we all know times that we've told stories to people, and we see they're not really paying so much attention, they don't have so much patience for the details, or whatever, they're just saying, okay, they did something bad, whatever it is, I got it. So they're not really focusing on the whole picture. And even if we could say that the speaker is actually saying something relatively accurate, but the report, the shema that's getting to listeners' ears is a shema shav, it's a false story. What the researchers call the leveling effect, the sharpening effect, they take away all of the rough edges and they make some of the details into bigger parts of the story, that they process the story in a way that's even less true, that's even less accurate, and we can understand perhaps how, even if we're saying something accurate, we are not necessarily conveying a true message. So all of this is a little bit scary if we think about it, because we want to think that we sometimes know what the truth is, and sometimes, as you indicated, and again, this is a whole other topic that we'll have to come back in the future to talk about at greater length, so sometimes you have to say something. Sometimes you have an issue of harm, an issue of protection to other people. We have this whole category of Lashon Hara L'Toeles. Now, when it's necessary and purposeful, so one has to say something if it's going to impact on the protection and the safety of other people. So it can't be, as one scientist wrote, that we have to live in a postmodern miasma where we can't believe anything, nothing is true, because we can't trust any of our instincts. That's not a viable conclusion either. But we have to recognize that we come with certain weaknesses and with certain biases. So therefore, among the many criteria that we find for Lashon Hara L'Toeles, the Chafetz Chaim, for example, has 7 or 5, depending on what he's referring to. Others have different lists. But two of the major things that we look for is that we try to the best of our ability to be as accurate as possible, to try to correct for as many of these problems as we can. And we also only say things when they're necessary, when there is an issue of protection, when there is an issue of safety or societal concern. So then we speak because we have to make decisions and live in the world and function. But we recognize that if it's not necessary, there's a good chance that a lot of what we think might not be the full picture, might not represent the story accurately, and therefore we're trying to be careful. We try to correct for that or to account for that in how we convey to others. So how do we manage to balance all of these many different forces that are competing for our attention and that are contributing to the decisions that we have to make in terms of what we say and what we don't say? So there is no easy answer. But perhaps that's the message of the peddler. That's the message that was conveyed, that somebody who wants to have a meaningful life has to consider these things very carefully, has to study these principles. This was the idea that the Chafetz Chaim himself took up and conveyed to the world, that this is not an easy yes or no, up and down decision. But we have to develop a sensitivity. We have to study these ideas carefully. It takes a lifetime, yes. But that's a lifetime well spent in terms of refining our awareness of how people interact with each other, what people really are, the complexity of human beings, and that's something that will yield great results the more we pay attention to it. And it's striking, and we'll just end with this because we're just about over time, I want to quickly review also, that we find that the story of Miriam, which is a very striking story, Miriam the great tzaddikess, that she should have this stumble and that she should have this punishment, the Torah tells us, doesn't only tell us the story itself, but tells us that we have to remember the story. There's a specific commandment, as the Ramban understands in his commentary to Chumash, there is an actual mitzvah of the 613 mitzvahs to remember what happened to Miriam. So it's interesting, there should be a special mitzvah for this. The Ramban says a mitzvah to keep us away from Lashon Hara. But that doesn't really explain it, because we have a lot of prohibitions in the Torah. And it's not the case that every prohibition in the Torah, there's a story about somebody who violates it, and an extra mitzvah to remember the story. So why is Lashon Hara so lucky? Why out of all the prohibitions in the Torah do you have this extra structure here? So Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Sher, who was the Mashgiach in the Slobodsky Yeshiva, suggested that this reflects the fact that Lashon Hara is very complicated, that this involves human interactions and human sensitivities, and we don't always know how what we say is going to come out, how it's going to be perceived, how it's going to impact others, how it's going to actually reflect the truth. It's hard to know that. This is not like eating kosher food. If you're hungry, you'll check to see if the food is kosher or not. You can make the decision in the moment. Here, this is a lifestyle, this is an attitude, this is a mentality which requires a lot of attention. And if even Miriam, this is something the Rambam talks about in his comment we mentioned before, in Hilchos Tumas Saras, here Miriam is one of the great kanios of Jewish history, one of our great role models, and she meant well with what she was saying, and she was speaking about someone who she deeply loved, someone who she raised, someone who she took care of as a little baby, someone who she cared about so deeply. If somebody like that, with everything in her favor, could still stumble in this area, so what's the message for the rest of us? The message is we have to appreciate just how complex this area is, and we have to work in advance to developing our sensitivities, to studying these concepts, to understanding just how they impact on our personality. And hopefully if we're able to do that, then we have a shot at this message that the Rochel was advertising of Ohev Yomim L'Ros Tov, that we should have a life not only in the next world but in this world, a life not only of quantity but of quality, of really understanding what people are about and what they can be. Maybe we'll take questions private because I think we're a little bit over time already. I just want to quickly review, maybe I'll take questions afterwards, but just to quickly recap what we spoke about. So we spoke about the fact that it's hard to understand why Lashon Hara should be prohibited if it's true. Why should there be anything wrong with saying something that is true? And we talked a little bit about some of the sources. We saw the Medrash about the peddler who came advertising this idea that the secret to a long life is being careful not to engage in Lashon Hara. We tried to understand a little bit what that means. We talked about the various sources in the Torah, L'Seilech Rachel B'Yamecha, V'Nishmarten Mikol Dovara, the idea of Tzaras, the prohibition to engage in activities that lead to tzaras, the story of Miriam, the mitzvah to remember the story of Miriam, all of that conveyed in the Torah as part of the message of not speaking Lashon Hara, and additional condemnation throughout the rabbinic literature to a perhaps staggering degree. We talked about the Rambam's four categories, about the Lashon Hara, Motzi Shemer, Rechilus, and Baal Lashon Hara. We talked a little bit about how those categories are not 100% clear from the Talmud, and there's some disagreement if that's the only way to see it, but those are the categories that we worked with. And we talked about the statement in the Talmud that Lashon Hara victimizes three people, but it hurts three people. It hurts the subject and the speaker and the recipient. So we talked about how it hurts the subject. That's most easily understood. The reputation is valuable, and then beyond that, an attack on the reputation could have other consequences. We talked about how it hurts the speaker, that it degrades the speaker, that it takes away from their ruach mamala, from their humanity as represented by the power of speech. We talked also about the controversy about whether Lashon Hara is a Chol Hashem, like the Chafetz Chaim said, and reflecting the idea that the Chafetz Chaim said there's no personal hana. So the Chazon Ish disagreed with that there's no personal benefit. We discussed the most common benefit, perhaps, the idea of miskabe bekon chaveru, somebody tries to raise themselves up by knocking the other person down. And we talked about the statement of the Chovos HaLevavos that after 120 years, one might find that their spiritual bank account is the opposite of what they expected it to be. And the explanation is because they spoke Lashon Hara, so all of their merits went to the person they spoke about, and all of the transgressions that person went to them. And we mentioned with Dessler's two explanations, either that their personal stature contributes to how much damage they do, so in order to mitigate the damage, they find their stature reduced, or their motive in speaking Lashon Hara was to lift themselves up at the expense of the other, so they find that situation reversed. And we talked about the whole quality of negativity, about how that itself is degrading and how that leads to building upon itself, to greater cynicism, as the Rambam describes in Hilchos Tumah Saras. And then we talked also about the fact that in this week's Parsha, so we find the source for the prohibition of receiving Lashon Hara, which is interesting on so many levels, the fact that we need an independent source, that it's not intuitive on its own, the fact that that might actually be the source for speaking Lashon Hara as well, which shifts the focus, and also the fact that the pasuk L'sis L'shem Hashav, which could be translated as don't accept a needless report, which would work well, but Rashi Nukhlas translated as don't accept a false report, which is a challenge to our idea that Lashon Hara involves statements that are true. So we went through a couple of ways in which we might think we're telling the truth, but it turns out what we're saying is not actually correct. We talked about how it may not be the full picture. We talked about how it's subjective and doesn't necessarily represent any objective truth. We talked about the somewhat horrifying reality of memory being infallible, about how that's true, even of what's known as flashbulb memories, about how not only do we lose memories, but we sometimes create false memories, which could also have a tremendous effect on what we're saying not really being accurate. And then we talked also about cognitive biases, about how we have a tendency in our mind to accept things as true that may not be true for various reasons. We talked about a confidence bias. We'll give more credit to people who talk very confidently. We talked about confirmation bias. We all have a tendency to believe that which supports our initial instinct, which is also part of a aversion to ambiguity. We don't want to have wishy-washy opinions. We want to have consistent opinions. We don't want to have to think too much about it. We talked about an availability bias, about a tendency to believe that information that we have the most access to and to weight that too heavily. We talked about the idea of group polarization, about how people will tend to entrench themselves in the opinions that people around them hold. We talked about bias, about the fact that people have a hard time even realizing that they have these tendencies and it's hard to correct for. And then we talked about how the idea of a makabel yosem and a omro, that the recipient is even worse off because of the teller-listener effect, that to whatever extent the teller isn't getting the whole story, the listener is getting even less of the story, that he's sharpening and leveling and doing other things to take away from the accuracy of the message that's being conveyed. And all of this are reasons where even if the person is speaking factual things, the listener is not necessarily getting a true story, is getting a shema shav. So despite the fact that we have an obligation of Lashon Hara L'Toelas, that we have to say things that are important for protection, we also have to be aware of all of these flaws and all of these problems, and therefore we focus at least on these two criteria, that when we do say something, that it should be as accurate as we can possibly make it, and we try to be aware as possible of all of these deficiencies, and that it should be necessary because there's only such an extent to which we can be careful for all these problems, so we also try to factor in that it's truly necessary what we're saying, it's truly important for the protection of others or the improvement of society. And then we mentioned the idea that in order to make sure that we have such an accurate read, that we have a sensitivity that's necessary in order to engage in this type of behavior, so we spend a lifetime refining our sensitivity. That's what the Chafetz Chaim taught us, and that the idea of a mitzvah to remember the story of Miriam, as the Ramban said, to keep away from Lashon Hara. So we have so many other Averis in the Torah. They don't all have a story and a mitzvah to remember, except that this, as Rav Yitzchak Isaac Sher explained, this is unique. This is an area where it's so easy to make a mistake. Even Miriam, with everything in her favor, could make a mistake. The rest of us only have a hope if we try to focus on the ways in which human personalities vary, the ways in which we can't always predict the impact of what we're saying, and spend a lifetime trying to refine that sensitivity, then we have a hope to realize the promise of this rochel, of this peddler, of Mi'a Isha Chafetz Chaim Ohev Yamin L'Ros Tov.
I apologize for going over time. I thank you very much. I wish you all a wonderful day. And Arya's there in the back.
Thank you so much.